This is Central Time. I'm Veronica Rickert.
And I'm Gene Purcell, filling in for Rob Ferret. You're with us on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. Coming up on Central Time, we'll talk about the 50th anniversary of the South African police raid that revealed Nelson Mandela's journals and papers and propelled his story beyond South Africa.
But first, we're going to talk about a quirky dinner happening next week in Hilbert, Wisconsin, in the middle of a cornfield. It's the second annual alfalfa dinner at Village Hearthstone Restaurant.
Now, alfalfa, of course, is a quintessential food here in Wisconsin, but it's usually cows that are doing the eating. Joining us now is Village Hearthstone General Manager and Head Chef Tracy Darling, who thinks that people should give alfalfa a try, too. Tracy, welcome to Central Time. Now, for the uninitiated, I know that there are a lot of farm kids in the audience, but for the uninitiated, what exactly is alfalfa?
Well, it's the hay that cows eat, and it's a very strong, hardy plant that has a good root system, and it grows very abundantly and well in Wisconsin, and it's the main component of cows' diets and among the other things that they do eat, and makes for great tasting milk and cheese.
And so, for the people in the audience who have not tasted alfalfa in its natural state, is there a way that you can describe it?
I would say if you tasted wheatgrass, mm-hmm. It has some of the properties of wheatgrass, but it's more fragrant and floral, and it is also a member of the same plant family as sweet peas. So there's some element of that sort of flavor in it, too. And it's very delicious, herbaceous. And very tasting of green, you know, it has a chlorophyll almost flavor in a very pleasant way.
So you're sitting there at the Village Hearthstone a year and a half or 2 years ago, before the first annual alfalfa dinner. What inspired you to even start down this path?
Well, you know, the farm-to-table trend is very much a part of the way people in this part of the state have always lived, and we didn't necessarily call it that, but we just grew our own vegetables and we milked cows and butchered them for meat, and the flavor and the freshness of those foods I think are what people aspire to today. So I was looking for something that would maybe get people's attention and would be a fun celebration of this focus on really fresh, locally raised food. And because Village Hearthstone is really literally, as is Hilbert, in the middle of cornfields and hayfields and all of that, I thought alfalfa might be a nice place to start. So we put a dinner together where every course had alfalfa in it in some way. And that meant that we would either juice the leaves, or I'd make an oil out of the leaves to marinate chicken in, for instance, or we would soak it in cream to make ice cream. And we managed to develop a menu that reflected alfalfa in a lot of different ways, from sweet to savory, and put it together with some other fun things happening throughout the dinner, and it was quite a hit.
So before we get to the spectacularly good dishes that you had, did you have any spectacular failures when you were trying to figure out some recipes?
You know, I've been cooking strangely for a long time. And we fortunately had good success with alfalfa, and I knew I was so familiar with it because I grew up on a farm myself and had spent a lot of time baling hay and feeding it to cows. I had sort of a sense of how far you could go with it. And, you know, we do start the meal off slowly for the uninitiated or for those who haven't actually eaten alfalfa before, and we'll start off with alfalfa sprouts in the first course just to kind of get people used to the flavor and to use something that they probably have tasted before or, you know, have seen in the grocery store. And then as the meal progresses, we use it a little more strongly in a little different ways. So once that flavor is familiar to people, they can appreciate the different ways that you can taste it with different ingredients.
So this is the second annual dinner. So the first one was a smashing success, I take it?
Yes. We don't have a huge dining room, but it was full.
Full is good. So the second annual alfalfa dinner, what's on the menu?
Well, this year we're starting with a little amuse-bouche, which is a skewer of local fresh mozzarella and some oven roast tomato, alfalfa sprouts, and we're serving it in a braised peanut pesto because peanuts, like alfalfa and soybeans, are part of the legume family, and they share some of the same flavor profiles. we're going to cook the peanuts, and they're a nice complementary flavor to the alfalfa sprouts. And then we'll move on to an alfalfa panna cotta, which is like an eggless custard, but it's savory, and that's served with a scallop cruda and cucumber and pea shoot salad. Again, all the flavors kind of matching each other. And then we relieve all of that with a mini alfalfa martini, and that is something that we're getting known for. We do make them throughout the years for as long as we've got fresh alfalfa available to us to do it. And that is served with a cold smoked bluegill crostini and some pickled asparagus that we just are making. After that, we've got some alfalfa butter tossed with hand-cut pasta and some house-smoked ham and local shelled sugar peas. And then we're having an alfalfa-cured pork schnitzel, where I juice the alfalfa and soak the pork in that along with some other flavorings and create a schnitzel out of it. And we're doing that with wild rice crepes and a maple balsamic butter and cream spinach. And we're ending the dinner with a pistachio tort that's filled with an alfalfa honey mousse and covered in chocolate. So I think if you get to the end of the meal, you will have a good sense of what alfalfa is all about.
Now, I imagine the audience for this are people who are sophisticated about food. And having said that, are they surprised at the end of it all, at the end of the first one of these that you have? I mean, did you have people literally say something along the lines of, I didn't think alfalfa could taste like that?
Yes, I think we heard that echoed throughout the dining room. And, you know, it isn't something that people consider eating themselves. But if you've ever lain in a field of alfalfa or been near a freshly cut hay field, the scent's very appealing and it feels very fresh and healthy. And it's widely used as a supplement, or people make smoothies with alfalfa powder and, you know, that sort of thing. So even with that, most people haven't actually tasted it fresh. So it is quite a sensation that first time out for most people. I think it's the alfalfa martini that really is the experience that people remember.
I'll bet it is, or not, depending on how many martinis they have.
That's right.
So let me ask a very practical question. So let's say I'm out driving along County Trunk P or whatever it is, and I spot a field of alfalfa, and it looks just like plain old alfalfa that the cows are going to eat in the winter and be baled. Is that alfalfa? I could just stop by the side of the road and pick that, and it would work?
Well, presuming the farmer didn't come out with his rifle.
Right.
And
always
find you there, but mm-hmm. Yeah, that's, I mean, we're using organic alfalfa that my dad cuts with a weed whacker because he's got a farm near here and access to all of that. But that is the alfalfa that we're using. Yep.
Do you ever run into people who are skeptical about it? I'm thinking of some of the farm kids I used to know when I went to school, and I just have a hard time believing. They would look at me a little crossways and say, "You're going to eat what?"
Yeah, there's a little bit of that even among the people who, you know, who work with it, perhaps more among the people who are more familiar with it. But once we get a spoonful of something into someone's mouth, they usually are converted. And because we only do it once a year, I think it's a great opportunity to try something that's such a big part of our agricultural culture in the state, but usually reserved for animals, of course.
And if you've got a second or two, could you share a quick recipe with us? Something people could try at home that's easy that might get them started?
Sure, you bet. It's pretty easy to make ice cream in general. And if you do have access to fresh alfalfa, we make our ice cream with it by simply soaking the leaves in cream and sugar, and we add a little fresh mint to that also. So any normal ice cream recipe that you would use, you simply flavor the cream part of it with fresh alfalfa leaves, simmer it on the stove very gently and quietly for 20 minutes to half an hour, and then cool it down and make ice cream the way that you normally make it. You can also use it to make whipped cream by simply soaking it in cold cream as well and letting that just be the flavor that you give the cream when you whip it.
All right. Well, that sounds, it sounds pretty tasty. Tracy, thanks so much for joining us.
You're very welcome. Thank you for having us.
That was Tracy Darling. Obviously, she's got some other things going on. People calling to get in on the alfalfa dinner, I imagine. She is the general manager and head chef of Village Hearthstone in Hilbert. And for a copy of the recipe we just talked about, you can check out the Central Time Facebook page.
I'm Veronica Rickert.
And I'm Gene Purcell. You're listening to Central Time on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio.
50 years ago today, the South African police raided a small farmhouse outside of Johannesburg in what's known as the Raid on Lily's Leaf. The house was the center of activists working to end apartheid in South Africa.
In the raid, police found journals and papers of Nelson Mandela's detailing his work against the South African government and his thoughts on using violence against apartheid.
The government used these papers to sentence Mandela to a life in prison. The activists used the trial as a platform for their beliefs. And here to talk about this moment in history with us is Edmund Keller, a research professor of political science and the former director of UCLA's James S. Coleman African Studies Center. Edmund, thanks for joining us today.
You're welcome.
Well, let's start with the Lily's Leaf raid. What happened that day?
Well, it was at a time when the ANC was under intense pressure from the apartheid government. Mandela had been arrested along with over 100 other activists fighting apartheid. But some of the supporters who were connected with the Spear of the Nation, the militant wing of the ANC, had been using this place at Lily's Leaf, a farm, as a communication site and also a meeting place. And they were in the process of meeting when they were raided by the South African police. The importance about that particular site at the time was that Mandela, after his arrest, had told his comrades that they should destroy all the papers that he was compiling relating to the possible armed struggle against the South African government. They, instead of doing that, tried to hide the papers away. However, they were discovered by the South African government. And Mandela, of course, felt that if it was found out what he was really up to, he could very well be sentenced to death. But fortunately, he wasn't. But the papers were taken by the government. And right now, they made available to the public as a sort of a testimony to the struggle and to the humanitarian principles of the ANC.
Well, let's talk about those papers. So Mandela had asked some lawyers, those close to him, to destroy these papers. Somehow they didn't get destroyed. I'm not sure why, but what was in them that was so significant?
Well, he was talking about the possibility of nonviolence wasn't working for the ANC anymore. The activists were very upset that they had intended to engage in some sabotage, urban guerrilla warfare and things of that nature. And that didn't seem to be going too well, but there was a plan for armed struggle. And that's what was so significant about those papers.
When the police raided Lily's Leaf, did they have an inkling that they were going to find evidence against Mandela there, or was that just dumb luck?
Oh, yeah, they had been tipped off, that the activists had been using this place. Also, what they were doing there was they had a radio station that they would periodically, unpredictably use to transmit the Freedom Charter message to the those who could get access to that radio station. But they would often stop transmitting too soon for the South African government to discover where they were. But apparently by this time they had found out that this is where the hub of the ANC was at this particular time.
Now, the finding of these papers would seem to be a blow to the anti-apartheid movement, a blow to Mandela. Apparently, he could have been hanged for the evidence in those papers, but it didn't unfold quite that way, did it?
Well, it did. In fact, it was a very serious blow. There were periods in South African history where there were blows delivered to the anti-apartheid movement. In 1961, there was the Sharpeville massacre, which was, sort of the state coming down hard on anti-apartheid activists. In 63, Mandela was sentenced at this Rivonia trial along with a lot of the people that were sort of a part of this militant wing of the ANC. And he went to jail, of course, for almost 30 years. there was, for a time from that point on, where the freedom movement went underground. Politics for black people were banned. There was heavy pressure put on non-black activists who were against the apartheid regime. And it was a pretty dark time. And in fact, things didn't begin to change until the black consciousness movement emerged in the 70s. But again, the South African government came down hard on that movement, killing one of its prominent leaders, Steve Biko. And, you know, there was periodic uprisings, but for all intents and purposes, between 63, or I should say, from the time of the Sharpeville massacre, the only black politics that was taking place in South Africa was underground, all the way up until the late 80s when the government began to loosen restrictions on black political activism and participation.
So it's been a long road for sure, and still some people call this raid the spark that ended the spark that started the fire that ended apartheid. Why is that?
Well, because it really raised the apartheid, the excesses of apartheid to an international level as never before. The Rovuniya trial was, and Mandela addressing the court in some of his very eloquent remarks about the importance of freedom for him and the rest of the oppressed people of South Africa resonated throughout the world. There began to be an inkling of white anti-apartheid movement that demonstrated peacefully for a good number of years after that. But also there emerged a sensitivity in the international community that something needed to be done to bring down apartheid. For example, the divestment movement got its start in the early 1970s. When activists were opposed to South Africa's connection with the Gulf Oil Company and also companies like the Kodak film operation was also used by the South African government to help document the identification of those that held under surveillance and so forth and so on. So there were movements against those companies. And then, of course, the seeds for the divestment movement grew out of that and also the consciousness in the world community about what was going on in South Africa arose. You have to remember, you know, when Ronald Reagan came into office in the U.S., what he was pushing for was constructive engagement with South Africa. And, of course, when you do that, you lay the groundwork for opposition to that as well. So here in the U.S., there was sort of a sides taking around that time. And, of course, in South Africa, too, even though the politics was banned, there was political activity, violence in townships against those who collaborated with the government. So it sparked sort of the beginning of various efforts of protest inside and outside the country.
Now, I've only got about 20 seconds left, but with Mandela lying ill in the hospital, does Lily's Leaf raid, does that mean more in South Africa today?
Well, it does in a way because, you know, there's so many other things that people have been thinking about that history of apartheid that particular site has not been talked about much, but, you know, I would suspect that in the next few days, months, I should say, people will begin to appreciate the significance of that that particular raid, particularly since there was a museum which has been constructed at that very site, shows, you know, the housing units where Mandela and his supporters lived during that time.
And Edmund, I'm sorry, we have to leave it there. We're out of time, but thank you so much for speaking with us today.
You're quite welcome.
That was Edmund Keller, professor of political science and former director of UCLA's Coleman Center for African Studies.
You're listening to Central Time. I'm Jean Purcell.
And I'm Veronica Rickert. When's the last time you were completely blown away by the wonder of a starry sky on a dark night? If it's been a while, that might be because darkness is getting harder and harder to find.
Losing darkness might just seem like the price of civilization. But our guest says when we lose darkness, we're also bringing on health problems and losing our sense of place in the universe.
Paul Bogert has been tracking the loss of darkness in America. He's the author of The End of Night, and he joins us now from one of the brightest places on Earth, Las Vegas. Paul, welcome to Central Time.
Oh, thank you. It's great to be here.
So I suppose it's tempting to think of all those bright lights as the mark of an exciting city, a thriving civilization. So why should we be worried about the loss of darkness?
Well, they are kind of exciting, and one of the things I say again and again in the book is that light itself is not the problem. Light is wonderful. It's light at night. It's a miracle, but we're using so much of it now, much more than we really need to, and it's costing us in many ways. We're wasting a whole lot of energy and money, for one thing. We're losing or have lost a view of the stars, of the heavens, and it's impacting our physical, mental, and spiritual health and the health of the environment that we depend on.
So you've been watching this and tracking this for your book. What is the evidence out there that darkness is going away?
Well, the simple evidence is just to walk out your front door and look and see what you see, which probably is a lot of light, and a lot of light that's shining straight into your eyes because it's coming from fixtures that are unshielded, and so they're casting glare. Or to look up at the sky and notice that you're hardly seeing any stars at all if you're living in a Western city, in Western Europe or North America. And so there's that first-hand evidence, but then there's also evidence that astronomers have come up with that show the true spread of artificial light at night, in such that it covers the whole east of the Mississippi now. There's really no place that we could say is untouched by artificial light.
East of the Mississippi, there's no place that's untouched, really.
That's what they say, and of course, I'm not talking about dark places like down in the basement or something like that. And on a cloudy night out in the woods, it's going to be pretty darn dark. But on a clear night, if you're just going out to look at the stars in your backyard, you're not seeing a natural night sky.
Is there a way to measure just how dark it is, how much light pollution there is, in other words?
Well, there are some ways. There are meters that folks use to gauge the light in the sky. But one of the most useful gauges that I've found is called the Bortle scale. This was a scale of darkness that was developed by an amateur astronomer in northern upstate New York. And he ranked levels of darkness from 9 down to 1, 9 being our brightest places and 1 being our darkest places. And so I borrowed the idea of the scale from my table of contents, and I have 9 chapters, and I start in chapter 9 and work my way down to chapter 1. So I start the book in Las Vegas, end up in some real dark places. And one of the things that really stands out to me about this, this scale of darkness is that most Americans live most of their lives in the levels of about 5 and up, so 5, 6, 7, 8, 9. Most of us just only rarely or even never experience darkness that would be in those levels of 4, 3, 2, and certainly 1.
Well, what about you? Did you find some of those darkest places?
I did. I had some really wonderful experiences, again, mostly out west, and especially in some of the national parks. The National Park Service now has a night sky team that's going around and measuring levels of darkness, and the National Park Service is now seeing the preservation of darkness in the parks as part of their mission, which I think is really pretty wonderful.
So for a lot of us, you know, maybe there's this innate primate thing that if things get too dark, we get kind of scared. So what is it that you find so, you know, wonderful and mysterious about these dark places?
Well, I have to admit, first off, that I'm one of those people who gets a little afraid of the dark. It's I know it's a little ironic. The guy that wrote the book about darkness would admit to being a little afraid of the dark. But I think that's totally natural. I think that's part of being human. But you know, what is also and has always been part of the human experience is this experience of walking out at night and coming face to face with the universe. And we've really more or less lost that experience, and it impacts us in ways that I think a lot of folks haven't really spent much time thinking about. So, you know, for generations and generations, this experience of walking out at night and seeing a real night sky has inspired artwork, certainly. It's inspired religion, wonder, awe, and a real sense of our place, not only in the universe, but our place here on Earth. You know, coming face to face with all those stars can make you feel pretty small, but I think for me, it also makes me feel large in the sense of understanding how wonderful and beautiful this world is, and how important it is that our role is in taking care of this world.
Now, you and I chatted by phone a couple of weeks ago, and you told me that you'd spent some time in Wisconsin and up on Madeline Island, which is one of my favorite places to be and where I've seen incredible night skies, at least to my mind. How does Madeline Island shape up in the darkness meter for you?
Madeline is probably going to be right in that three level, I would say. I was really lucky to spend 3 years teaching up at Northland College in Ashland. And I remember in my job interview, the committee was extolling the virtues of the darkness in that area as a way of enticing me to come up and work there. So, yeah, I mean, there are real beautiful areas of darkness left in Wisconsin. If you go across the border to the Boundary Waters in Minnesota, you can find some real beautiful darkness. But just everywhere is feeling the impact of artificial light. I grew up in Minneapolis, and my family has a cabin in northern Minnesota. So when I was a kid, we had real darkness. We had probably what would rank about a 3 or even a 2 on that Bortle scale I was talking about, where you'd stand on the end of the dock and watch satellites pass through these just sugary spreads of stars, just amazing numbers of stars. And, you know, I go back there now and it's still dark and it's still beautiful, but I can tell it's not the same. I can tell there's light on the horizon and light in the sky from the surrounding towns.
Wow. Sugary spreads of stars. Now, that's something everybody's got to want to see. I know. I mean, how do you know if you're seeing, you know, because most of us can look up and say, yeah, there's a few stars, but how can we tell when we're really not seeing the full view?
Well, I talked to a number of astronomers, mostly, and dark sky advocates who gave me a few rubrics for that. I remember Bob Berman, an astronomy writer in upstate New York, who said, he really thinks it takes about 450 individual stars for us to have that experience of kind of, wow, like this is something amazing. To put that in perspective, in many American and really cities all over the world, you walk out at night, you're probably lucky to see about 25 individual stars. And the human eye, which is really, I don't know if people understand how remarkable the eye is in terms of seeing at night. On a normal natural night, we ought to be able to see about 2,500 individual stars. So again, Berman put this number at about 450 as the moment when you're kind of like, oh my gosh, you know, this is this is amazing.
That's the wow number.
Yeah, that is the wow number, at least for him. And I would just say a lot of folks would just say, if you can see the Milky Way arcing overhead, that's, you know, that's when you're going to be filled with wonder and kind of realize what you're missing the rest of your life. So,
Well, when we come back, I want to talk about some of the health effects of missing darkness. We've been talking about the wonder of true darkness as we speak with Paul Bogard. He's the author of The End of Night, Searching for Natural Darkness in an Age of Artificial Light. And we'll pick up that conversation in just a little bit. And we're curious to hear what you have to say. What is the darkest natural place you've ever been? How did it make you feel? And how do you feel about the dark places on Earth disappearing? You can call us at 1-800-642-1234. That's 1-800-642-1234, or post on the Central Time Facebook page. I'm Veronica Rickert.
And I'm Gene Purcell. You're listening to the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. You're listening to Central Time. I'm Gene Purcell.
And I'm Veronica Rickert. We're talking darkness this hour and the way that our modern, brightly lit lifestyle is threatening our view of the sky and our health. Our guest is Paul Bogard, the author of The End of Night. And, Paul, before we get to the health stuff, let's take a call next. We have Monica in Greenfield. Hi there.
Thank you for taking my call and for this program. I feel very strongly about the need of having darkness at night, but the reason for when we sleep. But the reason for my call is because this program reminds me of the darkest place that I have been at, which is my hometown. I grew up in central Mexico, right between Mexico City and the border with the United States. Mm. And the second time I went back home, this place is a mile and a half above the level of the sea. And growing up, people used to tell me that Zacatecas, my hometown, had the darkest blue sky ever. Well, this day that I came back home, it was in the middle of the night. It was probably around 2 in the morning. And I came out of the plane and into the open airport, and I looked up at the sky, and I started crying and weeping because I really got that feeling that this is so beautiful. And we used to see the Milky Way from there.
Mm. Mm. You describe it beautifully. Paul, have you been in that area?
I haven't, actually, but hearing that, I would love to go.
Oh, thank you so much for that call. We appreciate that. And another one from Anne. Anne is calling from Harbor Springs, Michigan. Hi there, Anne.
Hi. I lived in California for about 11 years, between 91 and 2002. And I used to go camping and go to different places. And at some point, I went to the Death Valley Desert. And I believe that's where it was that at night, when I looked up and I saw how many stars could be seen, how many stars were in the sky, I couldn't believe that I had lived this long and never known that I could, that that could be seen. And I believe it was the Death Valley Desert. I went to a lot of places. But I wonder, aren't there must still be places in the West where you can go and see that.
Well, you described that wonderfully, too. I've never been there, but I think, Paul, that you've been out that way.
I have, actually. I'm smiling as I'm hearing your guest, your caller, talk about Death Valley, because I had one of the most wonderful experiences during my research, that, and it made it into the book, of being in Death Valley. Just a phenomenal place at night. And one of the things I think about when I think of Death Valley is, you know, our eyes, as I mentioned earlier, are really quite amazing in terms of their ability to see at night, but you have to give them time. And so I'd had the experience of being out at night for about 10 minutes and seeing a difference, and then maybe about 45 minutes and seeing a difference. But I tell you, after about 3 hours in Death Valley, it was almost like, if you've ever gone to the eye doctor and he's trying or she's trying to get the your prescription right, and they're kind of saying, is that better, is that better, is mm-hmm. that better, and all of a sudden they strike that one where everything is crystal clear. It's almost like after 3 hours the sky just developed in front of my eyes, and I felt like I was seeing stars that I hadn't seen before, and that was pretty amazing.
That does sound amazing. And that was in Death Valley, you said.
In Death Valley, which is, again, you know, obviously a national park, a place that you can relatively easily get to. I should say also that this night in Death Valley, as wonderful as it was, I could also see on the horizon the glow of Las Vegas. And so there even wouldn't be considered, as we were talking about earlier, a class one darkness, because that class one would be no evidence of artificial light.
Ah, Las Vegas, the brightest place. Paul, what are you doing there?
I don't know. It's it's a little ironic. I know that. So,
okay, let's take in one more call. Doug in Perry. Hi, Doug.
Hi, I'm calling from the town of Perry in Dane County, Wisconsin. And just like to let you know that here in the town, if you sit in a lawn chair at night and look up, we can easily count over 1,000 stars right off the bat, see the Milky Way, and watch the International Space Station going by, even though we're only a few minutes from the capital in Wisconsin here. And one of the reasons is, and this is the reason for my call, is in our town we passed a dark sky ordinance. And that ordinance requires people to have shielded lights, and outdoor lights, particularly dusk to dawn lights. And if you have an old light that stops working or finally fails or whatever, the new one that you replace it with has to be shielded. And if anyone wants to try their hand at getting an ordinance passed like that in their town, they can just come to the Town of Perry website. You can just look it up on the web and scroll down to ordinances, and you'll see the dark sky ordinance right there.
All right, interesting. Thank you so much for bringing that up, Doug. And Paul, can you speak to that? Is that a growing trend, these dark sky ordinances, which is, I'm assuming are efforts to lid the lights at night?
Yeah, what a great call. It's really wonderful to hear that. Another place you can go if you're interested is the International Dark Sky Association. That's darksky.org. They can give you a lot of information about these lighting ordinances. And, you know, listening to that call reminds me of something I come back to a lot in the book and when I'm talking with folks about this, which is, you know, this is a problem, I'm speaking of light pollution, that we can readily address. It's not to say that it's simple or that it'll just be overnight, right? But it is something that we can tackle. And that gives me a real sense of hope and purpose. Not that I'm not dealing with some of these other huge problems that are so important to our world, but light pollution is something that we can do something about.
Now, I want to get to some of the health costs of darkness. Now, there's the wonder factor, which we've been hearing about, and you know, you could just look at that alone, and that would be enough, I think, to make people care. But there are also health costs associated with the lack of darkness, aren't there?
There are, and I think you know, it was important for me in the book to make sure that it's not just a book of astronomy. It's not just a book about the night sky. It really is a book about how important night is and how important darkness is. And one of the reasons, one of the real important reasons that darkness is vital is that we need it for health, for our physical, mental, spiritual health. And just a way to think about it is just that all life on Earth evolved in bright days and dark nights, and we need both for optimal health. So the effect on the human body, you know, our body has never evolved to adjust to all the light that we have in the night right now. And so this is a completely unnatural experience. And what we're doing now is kind of an enormous ongoing experiment. We're just beginning to get some of the results from. And what we're finding is that all this light at night is disrupting our sleep. It's confusing our body's circadian rhythms, and it's impeding the production of the hormone melatonin. And this has been linked to the development of cancer in our bodies. So, so much so that the World Health Organization now classifies night shift work as a probable carcinogen. And with 20% of Americans and Europeans working at night, part of the time at least, this is becoming a real problem.
So does that mean we should do what we can? If we can't have total darkness in our cities, we should be buying light-blocking shades and things like that?
Yeah, and you know, again, the science is just emerging on this. But one of the crucial things researchers are trying to find out now is just how much light affects us. So you know, is light coming in from a street light enough? Is light coming in under your bedroom door enough to cause some of these problems? Really, you know, what's one of the earlier callers spoke to this, but we can do so much to move in the right direction, both for bringing back the night sky and for protecting our health by shielding our lights and not letting all that light just kind of spray all over the place.
And how hard is that to do in your experience as cities? You know, we heard from our caller there in Perry, Wisconsin. How hard is it to get the city on board with things like this?
Well, I won't, you know, lie and say it's simple or easy, but there have been a number of towns and cities, both in the U.S. and Europe, that have had good success with that. Much of the time, it has more to do with energy costs. When folks start to realize how much money, light, energy we're wasting, and how much less light you can use when you shield these lights or even turn the lights off part of the night, that seems to be the real motivator for a lot of places to have some of these dark sky ordinances.
And what about our obsession with our, you know, our electronic gadgets, our iPads and our iPhones? A lot of people wind down now by watching a screen, a TV or an iPad. Is that interfering, do you think?
Yeah, that's one of the things that I think researchers are really trying to focus on because of the ubiquitous nature of those screens. And the thing about those screens is that they produce a blue light, which has been shown to kind of affect our bodies the most. If you think about how we evolved, our body evolved to respond to blue light, that is to wake up when the sky is blue, when that light came out. And so if you think about, you know, you're lying in bed reading on your iPad or looking at your computer or watching television, that light is telling your body to wake up. And so that's, you know, obviously kind of the opposite direction of what we're going to want our bodies to be doing when we go to sleep.
Well, Paul, it's been so wonderful to talk to you about this. Thank you for helping us think about the night sky and the stars again.
Oh, it's been my pleasure. Thank you.
Paul Bogard is the author of The End of Night. And we'd love to hear about your favorite dark places in nature on the Central Time Facebook page.
I'm Gene Purcell.
And I'm Veronica Rickert on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio.